Welcome to a special edition of the Roundtable. This is part three of our project, Will We Ever Learn? The Struggle for Equality, One Group at a Time. Partial support for this project comes from Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The Mass Humanities grant is part of their initiative, Crisis, Community, and Civic Culture. It can be said a confluence of challenges has led to a fraying of the social contract, as Americans seem to be losing faith in the ability of our systems of government to deal with even the most tractable problems. However, history teaches that if the challenges we face today are to be resolved, we must find ways to reach consensus on the underlying causes of the problems and develop responses to them grounded in the best available information and in mutual trust and collaboration. This morning, we welcome two distinguished guests who have been doing just that throughout their careers. Michael Klarman is the Kirkland and Ellis Professor at Harvard Law School. He is the author of From Jim Crow to Civil Rights, The Supreme Court and the Struggle for Racial Equality, Unfinished Business, Racial Equality in American History, and Brown versus Board of Education and the Civil Rights Movement. His latest book is From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. Alex Willingham has worked directly advancing civil rights on the front lines with such organizations as the ACLU, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the National Jury Project. In 1989, he joined Williams College, where he taught, among other things, civil rights, voting rights, and Southern politics. He's currently professor of political science emeritus. Gentlemen, I welcome you both to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Let us begin. You know, over the last two programs, we've been talking about all of the problems. And on today's show, in this hour, we want to really focus on where we can make headway. And one of the things, Michael, and we'll begin with you through a conversation that we had the last time you were on our show, and a point of your book, and one of the reasons that I wanted you as a part of this discussion, in looking at the gay rights movement as an example, one of the things that you show in the book is that ultimately, compared to other struggles, compared to other fights, great strides have been made in a very short period of time.
I think that's true. Same-sex marriage is something that 25, 30 years ago, most Americans would have regarded as simply off the pale, something they really couldn't contemplate. And today, you actually have a slight majority of the population in favor. On November 6th, we saw voters in three states actually vote in favor of marriage equality, something that just had never happened before. And as I said, a couple decades ago, would have been inconceivable. The rate of change is really quite extraordinary. It was maybe a few years ago, it was maybe 1% a year more support for same-sex marriage. Now it's accelerated. It's actually more like 2 or 3% a year, and it looks like a trend that's become pretty much ineluctable. It's hard to see how this isn't going to continue to accelerate, and within another decade or so, marriage equality will have swept the country, and people will look back and really wonder what the controversy was ever about. That's an extraordinary change on an issue of social reform. You don't see that rate of change on really almost any other issue in American history that quickly. Maybe slavery during the Civil War would be an analogous example, but there you had wartime, which tends to accelerate these sorts of changes.
You both have worked diligently and have studied the civil rights movement. And Alex Willingham, when you look at that fight that goes on, obviously, all of these fights continue to go on, but progress has been made. Why do you think when it came to the fight for civil rights, it did indeed take so long?
Well, it certainly was a very, very long activity and a long struggle. We have to keep in mind, however, that the black population's presence in this country was grounded in forced importation under the slavery system and consequently became sort of almost quote-unquote natives residents, just as the others, in fact, did. And then what we see is a recurring number of challenges against slavery itself, against racial segregation itself, and increasingly now for some kind of more reasonable presence in the larger population in terms of equality and that sort of thing. So it's kind of, I guess, a lesson there that if we look at it, that the struggle is one that goes on, and there is a recurring group of opponents who come up here and there with their justifications for not allowing it to go further.
Do you think that the groups that have gone through the fight, of whether we're talking about women's suffrage, whether we're talking about civil rights, whether we're talking about gay rights, do these groups come out stronger because of that fight?
Well, I think, I'm not exactly sure any particular, I would say any particular one, but I do think there is a positive dynamic legacy of reform in the country that is there, a legacy that we can draw on, a legacy that goes back to the very settlement of the country, in fact. When you think about the great struggle for women's suffrage, a long one over the years. You think about the tremendous struggle for labor organizing and worker rights, really not peaking until the middle of the century here in around 1940s and so forth, post-Depression. You're talking about a legacy of activity that recurs where people draw on the prior legacy to participate in the new and the newest issues as they emerge, which is, I think, one of the things that happened with same-sex marriage. It simply found itself, promoters and supporters found it possible to draw on very simple and well-understood notions of equality, grounded in previous movements, and apply them.
Michael Carman, let me tweak the question a little bit for you, and that is, does it always have to be a fight? Can it be a matter of just human rights as compared to individual groups who are fighting for basic equalities and freedoms?
So I think it always has to be a fight, and I think that for two reasons. First of all, the people that are resisting the change usually have a material interest in preserving the status quo. So in the South, during the antebellum period when you had slavery, whites had a vested interest in preserving slavery. It was a way that white slave owners became enormously wealthy, having African Americans work on their cotton plantations, and they expropriated their labor, and many of them became very wealthy. Before the women's movement, before women achieved equality, men benefited from the status quo. Women didn't compete with them for scarce university places. They didn't compete with them for the best jobs. Women stayed home, took care of their husbands. You know, that was a situation that men benefited from. So, of course, they have a material interest in resisting changes. Same thing about the labor movement. Employers had very strong reasons for resisting unionization of their workforces. It enabled them to keep a larger piece of the pie rather than sharing it with their workers. That's the first reason. The second reason is people develop ideologies to justify the status quo, and those ideologies become very powerful. So to justify the system of slavery, whites developed theories of white supremacy, which preached that African Americans were different and inferior, and people came to believe that. Same thing with regard to the gay rights movement. You develop an ideology of heteronormativity, where homosexuality is either an immoral choice or it's a sickness. And, you know, that in fact is how psychiatrists regarded homosexuality until about 40 years ago. So that ideology developed, same thing with women's equality. The ideology developed that women were supposed to stay home, take care of their husbands, take care of their children, and they were not supposed to venture too far out into the public sphere. Those ideologies become very powerful. People are raised with a certain mindset, with a certain view of the world, and they find it very scary. They find it uncomfortable to consider changes to that basic worldview, and they resist it. So I think both because of a material interest in preserving the status quo and because of the ideological frameworks that develop to justify the status quo, any time you're seeking significant change with regard to social reform, you're going to have a lot of resistance and it's going to be a fight.
I talked in the introduction, Alex, about the need for trust and collaboration in trying to come to a consensus so that groups can move forward. How is that trust built? Because that's often a really tall order.
So true. Well, I think that it is a challenge, and it's likely to be require both a capacity to draw on the basic democratic principles that are associated with the founding of the country by certain sectors. That's the one thing. The other one has to do a lot with generating energy and the capacity to resist in populations that are discriminated against or exploited at the given time. And these are just issues that have to be worked out as the challenges are developed. And if one thinks about any one of these struggles, this is the kind of thing that you will in fact find. You also find a good deal of failure, a good deal of struggle to get things together until it happens. So I think you're talking in one sense about a legacy of participation and essentially democratic relationships and equality, which is there in the value system, and then the extent to which that might be drawn on to help generate activity on the part of persons that might be excluded at one point or the other, be that the slaves, be that the black Southerners under racial segregation, and so forth.
Michael?
So is the question how do groups manage to overcome their differences and pursue a unified objective?
I think the question is, when you look at the importance of trust and collaboration, of how you gain that trust.
And you mean trust within the group?
Trust within the group and trust within the greater culture.
Right. So within the group, I think, you know, groups often have different objectives. Members within the group often have different objectives. They have different strategies for how to accomplish those objectives. When the NAACP was deciding in the early 1950s, should we pursue equalization within a segregated system? Should we pursue integration instead? There were deep divisions in the 1960s. Divisions between Martin Luther King, who was committed to nonviolent integrationism, someone like Malcolm X, who was pursuing black nationalism and was not willing to commit to nonviolence. Within the women's movement, differences between feminists who were seeking equal treatment and feminists who were willing to seek something perhaps a little more radical, which is not necessarily formally equal treatment, but accommodations for differences. You know, there are always going to be those differences, and I think in some ways those can be healthy. I don't think groups are ever likely to universally agree among themselves what the best strategy is. In terms of achieving, you know, trust within the larger community, a lot of times there are stereotypes that develop, and one way to contravene the stereotypes is for people simply to become more familiar. So the strategy of the gay rights movement, the gay marriage movement, was to come out and tell stories. You know, here we are, we're your next door neighbors, we're raising children, you see us on the soccer field coaching our kids, and we're really no different than you are. And that was the formula for success with the gay rights movement. One reason why that hasn't worked to the same extent with regard to race is that the United States is still such a segregated society. Blacks and whites still often live in different neighborhoods. They go to different schools. And you don't have the opportunity to build up trust and familiarity if people live fundamentally distinct lives. So I think that's been a real problem. You know, obviously we've made tremendous strides on race, but we still have this difficulty that in a lot of ways we still have a segregated society, and that allows the stereotypes to continue to exist, and it's only through familiarity and shared lives that you can really retire those stereotypes.
The name of the project is Will We Ever Learn? The Struggle for Equality, One Group at a Time. We are talking about how to cross the bitter divide and make things better this morning. We welcome your phone calls, and we will go to those phone calls shortly. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. We're wrapping up our series on the roundtable, Will We Ever Learn? The Struggle for Equality, One Group at a Time. Michael Klarman is with us. He's the Kirkland and Ellis Professor at Harvard Law School. His new book, From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. Alex Willingham is with us. He is currently Professor of Political Science Emeritus at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. We do welcome your phone calls. We'll be going to those calls in a moment. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. A question for both of you before we go to the phone calls, and that is, when it comes to movements, and we haven't really talked a lot in this series about movements, obviously the civil rights movement, and we have the gay rights movement, and we think of these as exactly that, movements forward. How important is it, in your opinion, Alex, to have strong leadership in that regard within the movement?
Well, I guess that I can't be opposed to strong leadership, so I'll just say it is important. I think, though, that I'd be more concerned about the capacity to generate support and a large constituency and that sort of stuff. And that constituency might be composed both of the persons who are parts of the group, race or gender or sexuality and what have you. And it's very useful and important allies external to the group who are themselves more basically connected to a larger democratic ideology and perspective.
The civil rights movement had such a name and a face when it came to Martin Luther King. And obviously it's a multifaceted movement that continues, but it has such a presence. How important is that? And then, Michael, then I'll let you jump in, Era, as far as looking at the gay rights movement that doesn't really have that, does it?
I think, though, that I would like to think about the civil rights movement as being a little more broader than Martin Luther King Jr. I think Martin Luther King Jr. came in and became a very significant and crucial factor, especially once he was murdered. But we want to talk there about a little more of a broader level of participation amongst a number of the groups that were involved that, in fact, kept a very interesting language about what the goal of the movement might in fact be. So I sometimes worry that if we think about the civil rights movement in a certain way, we may end up affirming kind of disparity and disorganization a little bit more. I thought about that when he mentioned Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, for example. So we have to keep in mind that there's always some contention. And frankly, I think in some ways that's positive. You got to think, what you can go out and say, we want freedom. Well, what is freedom? What are you talking about? What's the content? And that sort of stuff. And I think the same thing, a slightly different kind of thing if we move to same-sex marriage and so forth. But
Michael?
Yeah, leadership is really important. Any social reform movement is going to be confronting enormous obstacles, and one of the biggest obstacles is convincing people that change is really possible. Asking people to participate in a social reform movement can be dangerous, it can be costly, and people don't really want to do that unless they're convinced that it's possible that the world's going to change, and sometimes it looks like it's not going to change. So leaders inspire confidence, Leaders can go out and try to mobilize people, try to convince them that it's worth investing their time and energy, sometimes putting their lives on the line in the context of the civil rights movement. And sometimes leaders can act as powerful role models. So I think of someone like Thurgood Marshall, the head of the NAACP, who in the 1940s and 1950s would go and litigate cases in southern communities, and he'd stand up in the courtroom and he'd cross-examine the white sheriff, and this would be the only time that the African Americans in the audience had ever seen a black person interacting on a footing of equality with whites. So I think those kind of leaders can be incredibly important. The commitment of someone like King to nonviolence in the 1960s, I think, was incredibly important for the civil rights movement. And you have some of that with the gay rights movement as well. I mean, if you go back to the 1960s, when many of us don't even think there was a gay rights movement, there actually was. And there were leaders like Franklin Kameny in Washington, D.C., who were organizing protests, who were writing letters, trying to demand change from the U.S. government, and who were trying to organize people to participate in a protest strategy. I think leadership can be incredibly important to social reform movements.
Before we go to the phone calls, and we do welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. Michael, you write extensively in your book about backlash, and are we beyond that somewhat in within the gay rights when it comes to gay marriage, or are we still within the midst of that backlash? It certainly seemed in looking at this last election as if we were moving just a little bit beyond that.
Right. Well, that's a great question, and I suppose we'll find out. The Supreme Court's on the verge of accepting some lower court cases involving the Defense of Marriage Act and involving gay marriage. In the past, 20 years ago, when the Hawaii Supreme Court tentatively ruled that same-sex marriage was constitutionally protected, it created an enormous backlash. Within about a half dozen years, 35 states and Congress passed statutes purporting to defend traditional marriage. And then the Massachusetts Supreme Court, about 9 years ago, squarely ruled in favor of same-sex marriage, and that resulted in 25 states passing constitutional amendments barring same-sex marriage, and it had a big effect on the elections in 2004. In 2012, things are starting to look a little different. The President of the United States came out in favor of same-sex marriage. His Republican opponent disagreed with that, but the issue occupied almost no attention, received almost no attention during the presidential election. And then, as you note, on November 6th, voters in three states, for the first time in American history, voted in favor of gay marriage. Now, it needs to be said, those were three relatively blue states. If the Supreme Court came along in 2013 and said, we are identifying a federal constitutional right to marriage equality, and that applies throughout the nation, you could imagine there still being a great deal of resistance in some of the redder states. So in Mississippi, for example, where voters rejected same-sex marriage by 86% to 14% in 2004, and there's still today almost surely a substantial majority in opposition, it would be interesting to see how much resistance there would be if the Supreme Court declared such a right and exactly what form that resistance would take. But it does appear to be the case that at least politically and at least at the national level, the Republican Party, which had been the primary opponents of gay marriage, have calculated that this no longer stands to their benefit to emphasize this issue in political contests.
8 years earlier, when John Kerry ran for president against George W. Bush, many said that the reason that he lost was over the issue of gay marriage. I'm curious as to, and this gets back to our earlier point, as to it moving forward relatively so quickly, but the importance of the President of the United States in the third year of his term coming out and saying that this is something that he accepts and supports.
Right. So people disagree about how important this was in the 2004 election. We should recall that Kerry would have been elected president had he won the electoral votes of Ohio, that he lost Ohio by 2 percentage points, and that same-sex marriage was on the ballot in Ohio. There was a referendum. Voters rejected same-sex marriage by 24 percentage points. It was a big issue in the campaign. President Bush wanted to talk about it as much as possible. And it's conceivable that enough voters in Ohio came out because of the referendum, because they strongly oppose gay marriage and they might otherwise have stayed home, or enough swing voters might have shifted from the Democratic column to the Republican column because they preferred the Republican position on gay marriage to the Democrats. So it may very well have determined the outcome, but political scientists are in disagreement. It is stunning that in 2012, the Democratic candidate openly embraced gay marriage. It was a prominent theme at the Democratic convention. It wasn't just part of the platform, but speakers continually outspokenly stated their support for gay marriage. And even though the Republican Party platform opposed it, it's not an issue that came up in the debates. It's not something that Mitt Romney wanted to talk about. How important is it that Obama came out in favor? You know, I think on issues like this, moral issues that people feel strongly about, they're probably not taking much guidance from politicians, even prominent politicians like the president. The one exception might be that the president's endorsement might have influenced some African Americans in places like Maryland. There is opinion poll evidence suggesting that African Americans were more supportive of same-sex marriage in 2012 than in the recent past, and it's conceivable that some of that reflected the president's endorsement. It might also reflect the NAACP's endorsement. The NAACP came out strongly in favor of same-sex marriage. It's hard to know, but it's possible that the president influenced some people.
We would love to hear from you. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. Will we ever learn? The struggle for equality one group at a time is our project. It is wrapping up in this segment, and we welcome your phone calls. We'll return to our conversation after this short break. Partial support for this Equality Project comes from Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Michael Klarman is our guest. He is the Kirkland and Ellis Professor at Harvard Law School. Alex Willingham also joins us, currently Professor of Political Science Emeritus at Williams College. We go to Williamstown, Massachusetts to begin our phone calls to speak with Paul. Paul, good morning and welcome to the conversation.
Good morning, and good morning to both you, Joe, and Alex and Michael. Great guests.
Thank you.
Well, I wanted to see if this notion of studies in equality could be applied in a political situation where you might have some leaders that don't reflect the values of their people. And I'm thinking, and the most extreme example, where you have an extremist leader on one side and an extremist leader on the other side that would characterize it, say, the Middle East or Israel and Palestinian politics. And you get the impression that the people there are being victimized by the extreme positions of their leaders. How would you take this kind of sort of studies of trying to shift ideologies or improve communications to change that situation?
Michael?
So you saw some of this in the context of the opposition to the civil rights movement. You had people like George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, Ross Barnett, the governor of Mississippi, taking extraordinary positions of resistance and indeed often consciously or unconsciously encouraging violent resistance to civil rights reform. Those were leaders who were popularly elected. They were irresponsible. They were taking positions that they must have known realistically could never be achieved. George Wallace was telling voters, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, we will never capitulate. Yet he knew full well that the federal courts were going to overwhelm him, that the federal military, if necessary, would be sent to Alabama to enforce desegregation. So you had a situation of an extremist leader who was popularly elected but was acting irresponsibly. At the end of the day, I think there's no solution other than voters not rewarding those people for their extremism. And the problem is when demagogic politicians tell people what they want to hear in order to win their votes, they're not always necessarily acting in responsible ways. There are some changes that can be made in the political system to create disincentives for that sort of extremist political leadership. One reason why George Wallace could act the way he did is that African Americans in Alabama were still almost universally disenfranchised in the early 1960s. If George Wallace had to worry about black voters, he couldn't have behaved in quite the irresponsible ways that he did. So ensuring that everybody participates might be one way of encouraging moderation. We have some problems with extremism in our own system, the inability to compromise on issues like taxes and reducing deficits and dealing with long-term entitlement spending problems. Our political system encourages that extremism. We have a system today with such proficient gerrymandering in the House districts that the only elections that matter anymore for most House members are their primaries. So they have incentives to run to the extreme because those are people who vote in primary elections. And in the general election, they don't really have to worry about running to the middle because, realistically, they're not being competed against in the general elections. So there are some changes you can make structurally to encourage moderation, and those might be pretty useful things to do.
Alex?
I would make 2 points. One, in going to this business of the constituency with regard to the old Southern governors and the segregation states, there's no doubt about the fact that they could carry on the way they did, in part because they had small white voters putting them in office. In many cases, one takes the case of Virginia, for example, or South Carolina, just to draw on a couple, you had very low voter participation generally, and that was overwhelmingly white, despite the presence of the black population. So they, the Byrds and the rest of them, could behave in those kind of ways. So I think I would definitely call that to our attention as we think about it. I think the other hand, the other thing is to think about the utility to a politician of playing this kind of hand and playing this kind of game when he's in fact running for office, even if it's for national office. It becomes a way of sort of part of the political platform to make these kinds of appeals when they are hostile to minority populations, but may in fact get voters from other places. Indeed, it looks to me like that's close to what happened in the recent presidential election with the Republicans going one way in that regard and the Democrats going the other way. And it was also a signal that really galvanized support for a whole lot of people as they thought about how to cast their ballots in this case. So at least a couple of those kinds of things, I think, we might want to keep in mind.
Realizing, Alex, of how much you've worked in this movement and for how long you've been a part of this, do you get discouraged? Do you still get discouraged, or is it generally optimistic?
I think that I'm not optimistic, but I'd say not discouraged, in part because in a democratic system and frankly, the world in which we live, it's going to take activity on the part of people to get things done. And what is to be kept in mind is that must be done, that generating that activity, providing a rationale for it, remembering history, and so forth and so on becomes very important in that regard. So I don't want to go around talking in the black community, for example, about some heroes of the past that might ought to be, maybe have their pictures put up on the wall, but rather about the activity that they were engaged in, the things that they in fact did to make an effort to address issues of discrimination in this case and some of the other things that we've been talking about here. So my sense is that there's probably no easy solution. And what we are talking about when we talk about social justice is the need to be to stay on the mark and keep our eyes on the prize, if you let me use a not particularly original phrase.
Yeah. Is it a sense of, and we just lost Michael Klarman, but we'll get him back on the line in just a moment and go back to the telephone calls. But when you look at the fact that it seems that we have many opportunities for various groups to rise up and to and to take to the streets in a nonviolent way and say, we're not going to take this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that throughout our history, although in our recent history, we have not. Mm-hmm. And you do have to wonder, and this is why I asked about being discouraged, you do have to wonder, if not this, what? If not this particular situation, then what is going to take people to get off the sofa and get out and become mobilized?
Well, I guess one response I'll make to that is not altogether positive, and that is really about the difficulty we have in this country with participation.
Yeah.
We have embarrassingly low voter turnout, embarrassingly low voter registration, and that sort of stuff. We often have it represents, it definitely represents some activity that we need to increase and have more participation from it and more numbers involved. Let me just put it that way, I guess. But I'm not sure I'd want to be pessimistic about that. I guess I would want to rather treat it as a necessary condition that we're going to have to respond to.
Michael Carman is back. Sorry we lost you there for a moment, but we're talking about the moments where we as a citizenry become mad enough and wanting to change to rise up. We have seen that in this struggle for same-sex marriage in this country, but certainly there are many other issues where we have seen people, we have seen many people just become quite complacent. And the question I asked Alex that I'll turn to you before we go back to the phones is, if not now, when, in the sense of getting fired up enough to act in a nonviolent way to foster change?
So one pattern that emerges from American history is that groups sometimes will mobilize when things get a little bit better and it becomes possible to imagine change happening, but it's happening very slowly.
Mm.
So at a time when everything looks bad, then it's very difficult to get people to imagine that change is possible. But when some changes start to take place, you actually then have eruptions of protest. So I think about, you know, the urban race riots of the 1960s. Those came after the beginnings of the civil rights movement, at a time that change was already starting to happen. Congress was passing the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. So change was happening, but that change led people to reflect on their condition and to become angry at it and to erupt in protest. And you saw the same thing with the gay rights movement and the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969. Things were starting to change a little bit. You had situation in major cities like New York and San Francisco where the police were, to some extent, becoming more respectful of the privacy interests of gays and lesbians, not cracking down when they would meet together in gay bars and so forth. But then, in the midst of a crackdown in 1969, you got an eruption of protest, which was the so-called Stonewall Rebellion, which is seen as the beginnings of the modern civil rights movement. So sometimes the best formula for change seems to be you get a little bit of progress, people reflect on that, they realize that, in fact, the world is not set in stone, you might be able to achieve some significant forms of change, and then they get frustrated by the very slow pace, and you get an eruption. You saw that with the civil rights movement in the 60s as well, the sit-in demonstrations in 1960, the freedom rides in 1961. Those came many years after Brown versus Board of Education, and to some extent were a reflection of the frustration after having hopes and expectations raised by Brown, but then having very, very slow progress in the implementation. Suddenly those frustrations boiled over, and you got the direct action phase of the civil rights movement.
We are going to take a quick break and we'll return and get in as many phone calls as we can to fill out the hour. This is the Equality Project. Will we ever learn the struggle for equality one group at a time? We do welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. We're wrapping up our three-part series, Will We Ever Learn the Struggle for Equality One Group at a Time? Partial support for the project comes from Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. We are going to go to the phones. Before we do, however, I just want to thank all of the guests who have participated over the past 3 days and where we've had really meaningful conversations with Professors Alexander Kasar, Paul Finkelman, Becky Packard, as well as Carol Graham, and of course our guests today, Alex Willingham and Michael Klarman. Also a reminder that you can hear the entire series on our website, wamc.org, and just go to the roundtable page and you can hear all three hours of this series on that page, wamc.org. Let's go to the phones and go to Roger in Northampton. Roger, good morning and welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, a couple of quick comments. First of all, I grew up in the 60s. I was pretty much anti-establishment, very liberal. I am now in my 60s. My views have changed about a lot of things. Change is not necessarily good just for the sake of change. Always. I'd like to say something about gay marriage. First of all, one of my best friends is gay. In fact, I'm going to his house for Thanksgiving dinner. But I say this. Somebody asked Anthony Scalia regarding Supreme Court Justice regarding his views on gay marriage, and his answer was very simple, that homosexual sodomy has been illegal in all 50 states for 200 years. He has nothing else to say about it. I don't have anything wrong with the concept of some kind of a partnership, but the word marriage I find troubling in the gay situation. And I would also like to say that, you know, you can vote all you want. The major leaders of the major religions in this world are against it. It's against the teachings of many of the biggest religions, and they're never going to go for it. I mean, you can vote all you want. You're not going to change their mind. And the other thing I'd like to say.
Well, hold
about,
on. Let's stick with that for, because there was a lot there, obviously, Roger. So I'm just going to stick there. Michael, how do you respond to that attitude where you say, okay, there is this, obviously, this religious force, and but voting does, it does make a difference, doesn't it?
So I guess I want to say a couple things. First of all, I agree change is not necessarily good. But on the issues that we're talking about, I think almost everybody would agree that the way we did things in the past doesn't look very good. So we got rid of slavery. I take it that was a good change. We've dramatically moved in the direction of racial equality. We have an African-American president. I think most people would say racial equality is a good thing. We've moved from a system where married women were treated as the property of their husbands to a norm of much greater gender equality. We moved from a time when people could not work for the federal government if they were openly gay or lesbian, where they could not serve in the military, where they could be criminally prosecuted for choosing their own sex partners. All those changes strike me as unambiguously good. It's true, Justice Scalia, his position is if the government criminalized same-sex sodomy for a couple hundred years, that it can't be constitutionally protected. We also had slavery for a couple hundred years. We also subordinated women for a couple hundred years. I doubt most of us would regard the fact that we've done something for a couple hundred years as necessarily being a sufficient argument for retaining it. Finally, the point about the teachings of religion. I can quote you statements by religious leaders in the 1950s saying that racial segregation was God's design. The races were created separately. God put them on different continents because he didn't want them to integrate. I doubt very many religious teachers would take that position today. Their views changed. My guess is maybe not all of them, but many of their views will change with regard to same-sex marriage. You already saw that in the last election. There are many preachers who previously opposed same-sex marriage who now support it. And if the main argument against it is that the Bible tells us that homosexuality is an abomination, well, then I'd like to hear the response to the argument that the Bible tells us that slavery is perfectly fine, the Bible tells us that polygamy is the preferred method of doing things. You know, we pick and choose which aspects of the Bible we want to believe in based on how much, given our current mores, they offend us. And I don't think that it's a sufficient argument against same-sex marriage to pick out some statements in the Bible about homosexuality if we're not willing to treat biblical statements about polygamy and about slavery as binding any longer.
Do you, and this question is for both of you, do you understand the mindset of having that degree of I guess it's a sense that I just don't understand where, and this is no disrespect to Roger and his question, which I think is obviously an important one and a valid one. It's just I don't understand, because I would never feel equipped to say to a group, to say to say to women, I don't believe that you should have the right to an abortion, to say to homosexuals, I don't believe you should have the right to marry, to say to a certain group that I don't believe that you should be able to vote. How do we get over that feeling that we have ingrained in us that, as you said, Michael, where we pick and choose? Alex, where does that come from within us, where we cherry pick how we feel about certain issues and groups?
Well, if I try to respond to that by relating to that particular question, the one point I would raise here is the way we understand the role of government. And it seems to me that this is not a situation where we want the government to come in and get itself involved. It's out of its business. So this is not about whether there should or should not be a government proposal, a government regulation around same-sex marriage. This is a point which says same-sex marriage is between the people who do it. The government should get out of the way. We don't want it to do that. This does not interfere with other people's religions. If they've got their religions, then their religion says something, so forth and so on. So I think the thing to try to understand is the autonomy of the and the intrinsic significance of the individuals involved beyond the reach of government, which ought to be busy doing something else, and respectful of their particular religions, which they can work out themselves if that is what they have.
Let's go back to the phones real quick. I think we have time for one more call. We go to Jennifer in Massachusetts. Jennifer, go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I want to say that Michael quite eloquently summed up many of the points that I had to make. In regards to changing hearts and minds, we must challenge individuals to think beyond their comfort zone. And unfortunately, we live in a society that has become very intellectually lazy, and they would rather stick to the status quo, where their comfort zone lies, than to think beyond that. And also, people have strong prejudicial cores, whether it be racial, sexist motivated. And in general, people have become socially complacent. And I actually had a professor say that he can't believe how much our generation just rolls over and accepts things the way they are, because his generation used to take to the streets for everything. And not that political protests are necessarily the right thing to do, but what I take from that is just people used to be more active in social issues than they are now. And I would like to point out that our government is not meant to be efficient. It's meant to be effective, which means it's going to take time to think about certain issues, especially the social issues. And in addition to that, we have elected, whether it be through people's own affiliation with congressmen or just laziness as opposed to looking at their voting records and everything, but we keep electing congressmen and congresswomen who will vote against social change time and time again. And again, that kind of goes back to intellectual laziness and social socially complacent.
Jennifer, we just have a minute left, and I want to get Michael in just to offer any comments you may have on that, Michael.
Well, I think Jennifer's point's really interesting. In one sense, you don't see the sort of radicalism and protest of the 1960s, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the poor people's movement. You don't see as much of that direct action protest. On the other hand, it's hard to deny some of the dramatic change that's taken place in recent years. I mean, we do have a black president. I think people forget that for most of American history, that would have been inconceivable. If Barack Obama had not won the Democratic nomination in 2008, we'd have a woman president. I think for most of American history, that would have been inconceivable. And we have same-sex marriage, which is a change that's come about entirely in the last 20 years, which is the period that Jennifer identified as socially complacent. So I think it's complicated. It's true, you don't get the bubbling emotional protest of the late 1960s. On the other hand, you do get pretty dramatic social change continuing on race, gender, sexual orientation. So I guess I wouldn't be all that pessimistic.
The series has been, will we ever learn the struggle for equality one group at a time? And my thanks to both of our guests this morning, Michael Klarman and Alex Willingham. You both are terrific, and I thank you so much for all your work and for joining us this morning to discuss these big issues.
Thank you.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Partial support for this project comes from Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. A reminder, you can find the whole series, entire series, at wamc.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.